Hello and welcome once again to Countryside Matters with me, Jenny Devitt. In today's programme we'll be hearing about a rather special new bee centre in Shillingston belonging to the North Dorset Beekeepers Association. Bee enthusiasts Ian Condon and Bob Mora will tell us all about it. A couple of weeks or so back, keen Dorset walker Roger Sewell returned from a 200-mile walk round the county's ancient hill forts with his sturdy Dales pony Scarlet. We'll hear from them both. Well, Scarlet confines her comments to munching some hay. And finally, we'll hear from more of the participants in April's World Heritage Day and Jurassic Coast at 25 event, to whom Andy Worth spoke. A very smart new beekeeping centre opened recently on the edge of the village of Shillingston. It belongs to the North Dorset Beekeepers Association and it took over 10 years in planning and fundraising to get it built. Beekeeper Ian Condon has been very much involved in the new centre, which will be much more than just a place for the association's beekeepers to meet. At the heart of the association's work is education, teaching those who are interested the skills and art of keeping bees, but it's also focusing on inviting local schoolchildren and adult and youth groups to come along and learn more about these industrious little insects so vital to crop and flower pollination. I went along to the centre's official opening. Close to one side of it is a newly planted hedge. Was that, I asked Ian, intended to provide some of the nectar their bees would need?
Well, just to mark where our boundary is, and it's all native trees and bushes, so it'll give flowers, pollen, what have you, and a bit of shelter, because if the wind's coming in from the east, it can be a bit exposed here.
Now, so, you've all this bare soil here,
yeah.
Ian, that's going to be what, grassed over?
Yes, it has already been sown.
Sown with wildflowers too, by any chance?
No.
Bee food?
We considered that, and we'd like to do it, but just the practicalities of managing it, because this is where the bees are going to be, and because we're not just keeping bees, we're teaching people, so we need a lot of space around each hive. We would like to do some wildflower mix and that sort of thing, and we were hoping to do it out the front, but we've discovered that the car park's not quite big enough when we have a full house, so we'll need that grass for parking. But yeah, it's something we're considering, but not just at the moment.
So that's quite a big bare space,
yes,
at the moment. So
yeah.
How will it work? How many hives teaching hives,
yes,
will they be?
Yeah, it could be a dozen on there.
And it gets well spaced out.
Well spaced out, which will make it easier. We don't get in each other's way, because you could have half a dozen people around each hive when we're teaching sessions.
Now this is teaching novice beekeepers?
We run every year a first year course for novice beekeepers. Can't remember how many weeks, but it's most Saturday afternoons through till end of August. And at the moment we've got 30 students on that. And then we've also now got 24 students on a second year course, which is more than we've ever had before for a second year course. So they meet at a different time to us. That's the beauty of having our own centre. Before, we used to have to meet at the same sort of time because we had to hire the church centre. So we couldn't have that when we wanted it. But now we can turn up here, we can do beekeeping in the week if we want to. And it's the second year course, they decide amongst themselves when's the best time to meet. And we've got two master beekeepers running that.
So this is giving you a lot more flexibility then,
is it? Oh, a huge amount, yeah. We can...
Going to give you a bit, well, once it's already, fully in action. Already?
Well, yeah, since Christmas we've had courses going on in here. And because we don't have to book it, you know, apart from within ourselves, we had a microscopy day back in January, which was very interesting.
So I noticed the microscopes inside, yeah, there. So what are you looking at? What are you trying to find out through
bees?
The microscope?
Sorry.
Yeah, bees, yes. That's a surprise.
It's as much as to understand their morphology, but it's also means of, you can, if you know what you're doing, you can identify pathogens in the bee's gut, for instance, if you've got a powerful enough microscope. I'm hoping we'll be able to look at pollen in more detail, because that's just very, very interesting, the different shapes of pollen.
And would that help you to work out where the bees are foraging from the kind of pollen?
In theory, yes. You can send your honey away, It costs a little bit, but you can send it away to be analysed, and they'll look for nasty things, like chemicals and that, which we hope they don't find. But they'll also give you a report on what types of pollen there are in that sample. It's a bit late then, because by the time you get that back, the bees have done it. So, but it's just of general interest.
And am I right in thinking then that you can tell the type of pollen by the shape?
That's part of
the individual grain.
The individual grains are so diverse, but they are minute. The best way is an electron microscope, but we haven't got one of those.
I say you need to raise a bit more money to get one of those.
Yeah, we'll never do that. But yeah, pollen is very interesting. Lots of different shapes and different pores on the surface of them. I know very little about it, but
I can see there's the possibilities of spending endless hours looking through the microscope, discovering this miniature, this microscopic world.
So we look at the bees' appendages. We can look at the pollen basket, which has got a proper name, which I can never remember. I'll get told off for that. You can see where the wings have got little zips on them.
The pollen basket being the part of the bee that
it's
where it puts
the pollen.
Puts pollen, it tucks it into there.
But I've never managed to remember it.
And then you can study, of course, the wing structure then through the microscope.
You can see where the wings have got little zips, like birds' feathers zip up, as I'm sure you're aware, that the little filaments on the bird's wing can zip together.
Like little hooks, aren't
they? Yeah, little hooks. Well, the bees got the same on their wings, so that the four wings beat as two, so that it holds them together.
And so, Ian, so when you get a school party coming along, I imagine that would be a source of great wonderment.
Yeah. We're really looking forward to getting some other than beekeepers here. I mean, we've got the beekeepers here and it's working really well. But we are looking forward to getting children and other adult groups, maybe disabled layer of society who could not ever get into a bee suit. But they could sit at a window and see the bees just outside, just around the corner here. So we've now got two hives. What are they, about 5 feet away from the big picture window? So you can actually sit inside and see the bees. And we've got enough communication equipment so that the beekeeper can have a headset on and he or she can hold up a frame of bees and talk about it. People inside can hear. And then we've got another microphone which the people inside can ask the beekeeper a question or questions.
Marvellous. So it's wonderful.
But as Robbie said earlier, we're going to have to think about people in wheelchairs, how we can get them closer to the bees.
Safely, of course, absolutely.
Safety first. But there's no reason why we shouldn't be able to do that. It's just going to take time. There's so many things we want to do.
Have you got to raise more money?
Not at the moment, no. No, we've reached our two and a half million. A quarter of a million. 2,500.
2.5 million would be very nice sum of money, wouldn't it?
No, because we do make a bit of money on our courses that we run. So that will and over the past few years, that's been going into our building fund. So that will then become available to.
Today you've had the official ribbon cutting, the official opening. But when is it likely to be full capacity? This side of Christmas?
When you mean full capacity, well, I don't know.
When will you have everything here that you need to have?
The only things that are left to do, we're thinking of, we've got two porta cabins to store all the equipment in. One's for dirty equipment, one's for clean equipment. But we think we're going to need a third one for the grounds maintenance. But we might get a ride on lawnmower, I don't know yet. Well, certainly need a bigger one because we've got a lot more grass here.
Ride on lawnmower, not much use at the moment. Just looking at the soil.
No, that's a story in itself.
No grass to be cut.
That's a story in itself. But we are going to build a covered area in front of the porta cabins, where we can do any dirty work, where we can boil up dirty frames and make new ones and scorch things to sterilise them. And so that can be done outside in safety.
So, Ian, this is the start of a whole new adventure for the North Dorset Beekeepers, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah, and we can't believe that it was 2022, Robbie said, when we first had our little new apiary working group, which was now disbanded. As of the 30th of April, we no longer are the new apiary working group, because it's here, we've done it.
You no longer need a working group.
And it wasn't just the working group, it's everybody. I think that's the thing that's really amazed me about the whole thing, is the number of members who've got involved in some form or other. 3 or 4 weeks ago, we had 40 tons of gravel turn up and was dumped in small piles across the site. And 25 people turned up with rakes to level it all. One guy turned up in a tractor.
So that achieved it much more quickly.
Well, it helped. Yes, it was a big help. But yeah, so and everything we do, we've had a team of guys inside doing the painting. For weeks they seemed to be doing it because they were doing it so meticulously well. They've done an absolutely stupendous job of the painting. I couldn't do it, you know, in my own home. I'd love to, but I couldn't do it. I wouldn't have the patience. But they turned up for hour after hour and did all the decorating and lots more besides. So it's, yeah, everybody's... I won't say that people have come out of the woodwork. That's not true. But there was nothing for them to do particularly before. But now there's something they can really get involved in.
So they must all be absolutely delighted.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I don't think I've heard any negative comments at all. I can't imagine why there would be, but no.
Ian Condon, who's a member of the North Dorset Beekeepers Association, talking to me just after the official opening of its new bee centre in Shillingston. And then I spoke to the person who'd cut the ribbon on what was a glorious sunny day.
Well, my name is Bob Mora, and I'm here today as the guest of honour of North Dorset Beekeepers Association to open their beautiful new facility, which is a great honour for me. They've invited me in my capacity as the chairman of the National Honey Show, which, for those who don't know, is the biggest honey show and beekeeping convention in the world. So it's a very special event.
The biggest such thing in the whole world.
Exactly.
So tell me what the show actually does then.
Well, we are a honey show. Many people will have seen that at a county show with perhaps a couple of hundred entries on a show bench, perhaps jars of honey, wax candles, mead perhaps. We operate on a completely different level. We have 2,500 entries. They come not only from all over Britain, but all over the world. Last year we had 26 countries showing. And we have over 200 classes. Some of them are very complicated classes to enter. Some are very simple. So there's something for everybody. In addition to the show benches, we bring in, again from all over the world, the best speakers. And we record their lectures. Generally, we'll have 300 or 400 people live in the lecture theatre, but we record them professionally, produce a professional video, and that goes up on our website. And we've now got over 100 videos on the website. These are serious lectures, about 45 minutes to an hour long. And we're really proud of the fact that they are available free to beekeepers anywhere in the world, and they've been watched over 3 million times so far. So it's our educational outreach. So in addition to that, we have practical workshops where people can make things. We have a very big trade hall where you can buy not only obviously all the beekeeping equipment that you need, but we have a number of people selling things that non-beekeepers would like. You know, our show's in October, so with Christmas coming, there are ceramics with bees on them, bee jewellery, bee cosmetics, mead, of course. There's a company that comes down from Northumberland with a lovely sparkling mead. So lots for non-beekeepers to see and do. It's an old show. We are 103 this year. We had our first show in 1923 at Crystal Palace, and we were there until, well, I wasn't, it feels like it sometimes.
I'm quite sure you went there then.
But it feels like I was. But they were, my predecessors were there until 1936 when Crystal Palace burnt down. And after that, the show was peripatetic, had a number of venues. And about 12 years ago, we found Sandown Park Racecourse in Esher, Surrey. And that is a huge, huge open area. And it's allowed us to display the entire honey show and the trade show in one big room, and it is the perfect venue for us.
So, tell me, I assume you take hives full of bees, do you, to the show or not?
No. Health and safety at Sandown Park won't let us. Bees and horses, not the greatest mix. Not that there are horses there when we have our show, but it's their policy. The one time that they did allow us to break that rule was for our centenary, when we had a visit from Her Royal Highness the Princess Royal. And we thought, really, we've got to have bees on the premises for her. So we had what we call an observation hive, which is a glass-sided hive, so you can look in and see what's going on, but you're perfectly safe. So then we did, but that was the only time that we've ever been allowed to do that.
Tell me, given the fact that there's a lot more awareness these days of the plight of bees and the fact that we've lost so many and we've lost so many insects, are you finding that more people are becoming beekeepers because they're more interested in bees?
Yes, we are. There is a great interest. Organisations like North Dorset here are getting a lot of new applicants each year to learn beekeeping. Which is lovely. We do need to be fairly pragmatic with them, because it can be hard work, and they need to understand that it's a commitment. Bees are livestock. You know, I know it may sound silly, but it's no different to keeping a cow or a sheep. They have to be cared for properly. People have to understand that that's important. But many people are prepared to take up that challenge, and that is good. Just as a sort of tempering that, it's important that we don't overstock an area with bees, because there is a finite amount of food for them out there, and if you have too many hives competing for too little food, then obviously some are going to starve. So we want to avoid that. Less of a problem here in Dorset, where I live in Surrey. The density of colonies is actually quite worrying. You can go onto the British Beekeepers website, you can go onto the government DEFRA website, the National Bee Unit, and put in your address, and you can find out how many apiaries there are within 5 kilometres of you. And for me, it's about 250. And that's an awful lot.
Of course, there's nothing you can do about that to minimise the numbers, can you?
No, there is nothing. What we are doing, for a long time, we used to encourage urban beekeeping, particularly offices in the centre of London might have some hives on their roofs, and a number of companies took that up. But again, there is the issue of forage, and there are now so many hives on roofs in London that forage has become a real problem. So we're now trying to flip the encouragement, not to actually keeping bees, but to planting their roofs with bee-friendly plants. There is an organisation in London with the glorious title of Pollinating London Together, and they encourage businesses to put up window boxes or have a green roof or a green wall or whatever is appropriate for their premises. So that's kind of where we are now in rolling this out nationally. When we're at shows, we're going to be saying to people, of course, you know, if you'd like to come and learn to keep bees, that's fine, but what you really can do is to plant bee-friendly plants. And of course, the next question is, what's a bee-friendly plant? And the answer to that is you can get some very good advice off the British Beekeepers Association website, who have lists of plants. But armed with that, you'd be wise to go to a local garden centre and ask what grows in your area. And then pick from the list, because it's no good trying to grow something.
And of course, I suppose to do not pull up all those flowering weeds, because they're insect friendly, aren't they?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yes, a weed is just a flower in the wrong place, as they say. And no, it's very important. It makes me cry when I see the council mowing verges. You know, we spend our lives trying to say, look, please just wait until they've flowered and then do the job. But It's an ongoing work, and a lot of people are really enthusiastic about bees. So we.
Tell me, what do you think of this wonderful new centre? We're sitting here; it's a glorious day. There are two hives behind you, and they do seem to be very busy. What is your impression of this? How does it compare with what you might have seen elsewhere in the country?
Well, I get the opportunity to see a lot of apiaries because I happen to be an examiner for the British Beekeepers Association, so I go around to lots of places, and really there is very little to come close to this. What North Dorset have got here is the most beautiful facility. It's a fantastic building. It's very versatile. They're going to be able to use it for so many different types of educational work. They'll be able to have children in here looking out of the window at the bees that are flying. As you say, there are two hives just right by the window so they can see what's going on. It's a superb facility, and I've up in Surrey about 15 years ago, I was involved with a similar project building something not quite as big as this, but on the similar lines, and I know how much work it is. Just a huge amount of the fundraising that they've achieved here, it's spectacular. They've done so well. I think I'm going to steal some of their fundraisers and take them home with me, because they've done a brilliant job. So I'm very, very impressed, and I'm sure that now they've got this facility, more beekeepers will want to be part of it. They'll come along and join in, and more people will stay involved because there's so much here for them to do. It's not just, well, I've learnt about it in year one and year two, and well, I don't know what to do now, because there are people here who will be able to say, look, you know, you could learn queen rearing, or you could go into some woodwork. You can take beekeeping in every direction that you like. One of the things that just makes me smile is that I don't think anybody that becomes a beekeeper ever joins thinking, well, I'm going to do all these weird things. That you join because you fancy looking after bees, and that's fine. But then you get collared to get into the administrative side of things. And one of the things that I never imagined in my own local apiary is that I would be able to tell the TV trucks when they arrive just where to point their aerial to pick up the satellites, because I know where they all are, because we do so much media stuff there now. How did that happen?
That was Bob Mora, chairman of the National Honey Show, and we may well hear more about bees in the next Countryside Matters. You may well have heard in local news recently about Roger Sewell and Scarlet, the Dales pony. He's the man who walked 200 miles round Dorset with his Scarlet to visit each of the many ancient hill forts we have in this county. Although he didn't intend his walk as a fundraising exercise, because people donated to him along the way, he raised £1,500 for the Dorset Wildlife Trust, a terrific effort. Roger Sewell lives in Cheselbourne, where he and his photographer wife have stables for four horses, one of which is, of course, Scarlet. And that's where I met them both. So this is Scarlet, then?
This is Scarlet.
How do you do, Scarlet?
She is black with two little white feet socks at the back, and she's a registered Dales pony, which are the rare breed native pony. They're the largest, or one of the largest, native breeds. And they... There we go. I'm just putting her little rope head...
How old is she, Roger?
She's 10. Well, next month she'll be 10. So in horse years, that's 10.
That's still quite young for a horse, isn't
it? Yeah, so we've got lots of adventures still ahead of us. And we've owned her for about 4 years. So I'll just lead her out, and then you'll see how... She's not very tall, but she's very, very strong.
She's a very sturdy horse, isn't she? I can keep well out of the way of those really rather large hooves.
But the Dales pony was a horse that was used up in the Yorkshire Dales, originally as a farmer's horse, but then they carried lead across the Pennines, and that was their role.
And you can just see the size of them, the sheer sort of strength, why they would have been so suitable to that. So when Scarlet came into my life, and at the same time I was thinking of doing these long-distance, multi-day walks, I thought that's ideal. I've got one of the original pack horses, and I can start putting these adventures together.
Had you ever done anything like that before?
Well, no, never. I'd always had this dream of doing multi-day walks with a horse, but my first trip I did in 2004 with her was in late October, really the wrong time of year, and I tracked from my childhood home in Surrey, near Gatwick, all the way back to Dorset, so 200 miles there.
And I bet having left Gatwick behind, you were very glad to head west.
It was. I had the aeroplane. I went underneath the flight path to start with, and mile by mile, they got higher and higher. But I was so unprepared for it. It was late October into early November. The days were set against us. The weather was horrible. And my body just fell apart. It was.
If I may say so, Roger, might have been a slightly foolish time of year to have picked.
It was. So I took 18 months after that and thought, OK, I'm going to plan this better next time. And that's where the Hill Force idea came to mind, because I've lived in Dorset now for over 25 years. And I've known that there were perhaps about 10 hill forts in Dorset, but as I researched it, I started discovering there were over 30. And then my interest actually lay in what could I find in between the hill forts. So if I used them as sort of like beacons, I quickly figured out people would have, thousands of years ago, travelled in between the countryside. The landscape perhaps would have been quite similar, and all of us would have changed. So I thought, actually, that's really interesting to connect them up. And I walk with Scarlet.
Because those hill forts would have provided the travellers with somewhere safe to rest, food, lodging, wouldn't they, presumably?
Yes, so I think the hill forts originally are safe places to retreat to when there's raids and things like that. And everyone
Would there not have been people living within them?
But they didn't have water up there, so they were more defensive, I think. But when you do walk like I've done, or you go to any of these hill forts and you climb up to the top of them, you suddenly see how strategically they are placed. They are commanding views across Dorset, and when you're on one, you can see another one, and you can see the estuaries of the rivers, like Maiden Castles, on the strategic place from the River Froom coming up there. And Egerton Hill, for example, you've just got amazing views right across. It commands. When I got there, we got to Egerton Hill, and I wanted to get up there for sunset, and I only had about 20 minutes, so it was quite a scramble for Scarlet and I to get up there. But when we got there, and you look back where we'd walked over 100 miles across Dorset by that point, and you can just see every ridgeline, every valley, and you start seeing where... I started really feeling where old travellers would have gone and how to read the landscape for where water might have been or shelter might have been. So that sort of countryside landscape sort of infusing back into me was the closest I'd got at the top of Egerton Hill to thinking about how it might have felt for someone several thousand years ago to exert themselves to get up there, to travel across the county. So that was a big moment.
And of course, standing up there, if you've been would have been a Neolithic person, say 3,000 years ago, you'd have looked out at part of Lyme Bay.
Yeah.
And thought that, you know, the ocean just went on forever, I suppose.
Yes. So I definitely got this feeling of stepping back in time. And because walking with Scarlet is a much slower pace than I walk myself, and before I've always just rushed along trying to, you know, get to one place or another.
As we do.
So this stepping back with Scarlet, and because there's a responsibility to stay with Scarlet, because you can't just leave her, you become very aware of where... Oh, well, I became very aware of where I was, the time of day, where water was, what Scarlet was eating. And then, Jenny, the other really extraordinary thing happened was... Because we were, perhaps Scarlet draws people in and she's a novel thing with all her pack on the back and I'm walking, not riding, so many people just came over to stop to have a chat and ask me about what I was doing and where I was going. And that interaction Scarlet, you know, in Niger, people want to sort of say hello to Scarlet, but then the conversations start. And that gave me a real sense of encouragement and fun to meet so many people. So that kindness or that interest was really extraordinary, actually, and I think we've missed a lot of that. And then
And presumably, Scarlet, who's having a lovely time munching away on this nice bale of hay, she is a very placid, tolerant sort of character, is she?
Well, interesting enough, I like to think that, but at times she can really tow me around the countryside, and I only lead her a little red rope head collar. So we have a very interesting relationship where at times she definitely takes charge.
She decides this is the way I want to go, and that's the way you have to go.
Yeah, and it was interesting. We stayed in a lovely equestrian place that had a big show on at one time, and we definitely felt out of our depth when we got in there with lots of other horses all trotting around in circles. So I think the two of us like the hills and like the space that we've got. But as I was saying, the thing that then happened was I'd planned to camp most nights, and Scarlet got my tent, and I did camp a lot of nights. But a lot of people started saying, would you like to stay undercover, or would you like to stay in our shepherd's hut, or something like that. So the hospitality, and then they came out with a plate of food or invited me in for supper, that hospitality and warmth that this journey generated was very special.
And you wouldn't encounter that under normal circumstances at all, would you?
I've never encountered. I've done lots and lots of walking in my time, and as a man, I might meet another man, and we might sort of go, oh, hello, whatever, as you walk past. But that would be it. But people stopping their cars, opening the windows, saying, "What are you up to? Can I?" You know, went past shops, and they came out with a carrot for Scarlet, and sandwiches for me, or a meal in the evenings was a lovely experience.
And I suppose, Roger, as much as anything, they were wondering, why on earth isn't he riding that horse?
Yeah, I had that a lot of times, and I even heard two people saying, why are you riding that horse? But I do ride Scarlet, but not with all her kit on, that as you can see. But the walking part of it is so special, because you are an equal partner, and our paces started matching, our even footsteps started matching. And we got to places where we had some really difficult, most of the paths were really open, but we had some really difficult paths across one day. And we had lots of huge logs to cross over. And I've been trying to, some people want to take some pictures, and I've been trying to get Scarlet to step over some logs, and she refused, absolutely, said, no, I'm not doing that for the camera. And then we got to this block path, and we committed to go down. And once we committed, I knew we couldn't get back. And I just let Scarlet lead, and she stepped over logs that were scraping her middle through thickets. And each time we got over something, she stopped, she waited for me to scramble over, and then we went on again. And that, to me, was like a mare really lead, because mares are actually the ones in the herd that would lead that herd. So that mare, Scarlet, really felt like she took charge of certain situations.
So that sounds to me, Roger, as if you learned to trust her.
As the
creature who could read all the signs that you might not necessarily have read at all, the signs in nature.
Yeah, definitely. And she became so much stronger through things. She could drink what she needed, she could eat what she needed, and there was I with all my kit, she was carrying it all. So in the end, I think she was probably leading me around the county
have been delighted when you knocked on the door and she was able to help herself to that person, that unfortunate person's flowers.
Exactly. So I did have to knock on doors, and that is exactly what happened at times. I rang the doorbell, and while I was trying to politely say, can I fill up with water, she would be in the flower bed eating whatever she could. But we got away with that. So hopefully, apologies for anyone if they came home and found flowers chewed. It was probably Scarlet on that. But something really profound happened to me, and that was I started thinking about why, over and above Scarlet's charm, why people were giving me so much attention. And I think in the end I started seeing that news, and this, you know, interesting, that the way that information has changed in our lives with all our news apps and the way that it comes at us is so instant, and we've got access to the whole world, you know, at our pockets,
whether we like it
or not, but it's there. And lots of people saying, I'm feeling overwhelmed by all of this stuff. And I think for me what happened was there was a story that I was bringing with Scarlet, sort of stepping back to how information and news would have originally traveled with the pack horse trails and people travelling, and that potentially would have been very important information to rural communities. And so that old-fashioned way of face-to-face information storytelling, I've never seen that before in the way that Scarlett showed me on this. And I think that's something that we perhaps lost. I mean, it's important we stay up together with things, but that connection with individual people's stories and things.
So a traveller then was always somebody of interest. As you were saying, Scarlett, so a traveller, somebody who arrived from another village, would be a person of considerable interest and importance, because they would be bringing information, which probably grew in the telling, didn't it?
I think so, and they would become, more they came past each time, they would become more and more reliable. And as people, we are designed to read other people's faces and what people say, and to know whether we trust it. So at this age, where sometimes it's difficult to quite fathom out quite what's going on. So that historical way of information passing, the pack horse trails, I started thinking they are the old highway of information that would have crossed the country. So that never occurred to me before I'd done this with this walk with Scarlett.
And of course, the wonderful thing, since you were doing this walk to raise money for Dorset Wildlife Trust, every time somebody stopped you, I suppose that gave you an opportunity to ask them for a donation.
So, yes, so people were really generous, and I had set out on this walk to discover nature recovery. That was one of my original goals between across Dorset. So as a land agent, you know, I've worked in the countryside. So nature recovery, I think, is so important, and I was really pleased to have Dorset Wildlife Trust backing for the walk.
Because you're not very far away from one of the jewels, or the newer jewels in their crown, Liscombe Farm.
Yeah, so I started, that's what I did, so I thought I'd start, as well as the Hillforts, I'd start at Liscombe Farm, which is really close to here, and that's the new nature reserve for Dorset Wildlife Trust, and then I'd walk over to Kingcombe, near sort of Powerstock. And then my third one would be to Wild Woodbury over at Bear Regis. And the importance, I mean, what's interesting for me is Scarlett, I love seeing the countryside. And as you can see, Scarlett here, I mean, she wants to eat everything she comes across. But what was so important and was things like water became really important to me during the day. And one day we nearly ran out of water. And that things that we take for granted.
That was water for you and Scarlett as well.
And so I started thinking, actually, these resources are so important. And the way that nature recovery is shaping up now on a much more balanced way, with farmers doing much more of growing crops, but also thinking about nature recovery. That was really profound for me, across the county like that. So yes, having Dorset Wildlife Trust there and met some of their rangers on the way, and they started telling me about the work they're doing was an important part.
And talking about nature, and I couldn't help noticing in one of the stables behind you, the swallows diving in and out. How lovely.
Yes, so the swallows here are really interesting for me, because when first I got Scarlett, I was wondering what we should do with her.
Someone has got a bit of a touch of a cough there.
That's not Scarlett, that's her friend. Yeah, so I remember one morning and I looked into Scarlett's stable and I saw
the swallows. So you, how many horses have you got here, Roger?
We've got four horses here.
And you ride them all, you and your wife?
Yes, me and Lucy, and we've got a young foal here, and then we've got our children's pony that's been with us forever. But if you look up in Scarlett's stable there, you can see a little nest.
So you have. Is that occupied at the moment?
Yes, it is. And they're flying about. And it was one morning when I came here and I was feeding Scarlett, and I saw that those birds just arrived in late April. And it made me realise that they too were long-distance travellers, and they'd flown all the way over from Africa. And
all of about 6,000 miles from southern Africa.
Amazing, these little birds. And they got home again.
And they'd had to cross the Sahara, which luckily you didn't have to do.
So my thing is, all the hardships I ever find, I think back of these little birds and think, naturally, I've got it easy. But that made me realise that there are all sorts of things that are effectively doing these long journeys and things like that. So they gave me encouragement or the inspiration right at the beginning.
Roger, shall we move away? Because
yes.
If they've got chicks in that nest, we might be disturbing the adults when they come back with food. Or they might dive bomb us.
Yes,
let's
do that. Let's go back to Scarlet.
Go back to Scarlet. And a very, very sturdy rump she has.
Very powerful, you see. You can just feel the strength.
Well, it's from going up and down those Yorkshire dales, isn't
exactly,
it? All those hills.
Yeah. So she makes a perfect pack horse like this.
So they were only ever pack animals, never ridden occasionally.
No, they were ridden. They were ridden as farmer's horses, and you see old pictures of them carrying with someone there.
Weren't used to pull the plough.
Yeah, they would have been, because they would have been.
So they were of all-purpose ponies.
And they also, the history of this particular breed is, like many horses, they got drafted into the First and Second World War. And because they were the largest native breed, they became well-known for pulling artillery. And they got down to, because of all the horrible things that happened, you know, it's very tricky to talk about it. But they nearly got wiped out as a breed. And it was
of their use during the wars.
Yeah, due to the war, and they all got either killed out there or left out there in France. And only officers' horses, you had to pay to bring a horse back, so horses didn't get brought back. So actually, the Dales pony, the history is well known for their role in the wars. And one of the things on this walk I wanted to do was we were going past the Tank Museum at Bollington. And out of sort of respect and the time that these horses, this breed, gave to the army, I thought I'd like to take Scarlet back to meet a tank. And not to glamorise anything, but just out of respect. And it's like when I came back from my first walk from Surrey to Dorset, we walked through the centre of Winchester, and there's a little stone trough in the on the top of the high street in memory of all the horses.
You took her down the high street in Winchester.
Yeah, all packed
that will have stopped the traffic.
It definitely stopped the traffic. That was on my first trip. We didn't know any better, and the route went through Winchester, so we just went through it. And there's a little trough there which says, to memory of all the horses lost in the Boer War. So all through history, horses have been used for warfare. And
so they were shipped out to South Africa to fight in that war too, then,
in the
late 1800s.
Yes. So all the way through, horses have had such an impact on humans, and war's just one of it, and I don't like that side of it, but I thought it was important to take Scarlet there and recognise what they'd done.
And so the fact that these ponies, these horses were used in the wars, that's what's turned them into a rare breed, is it?
Yeah, definitely, because I think they got down to something like two brood mares left or something very close, I'm not quite sure what, and I think now there's between 500 to 1,000 ponies like Scarlet left as broodmares.
Now, this begs the question, of course, Roger. Had you ever thought of breeding from her?
Yeah, so I have, and I think I will. I would like to, but I've also got some adventures to do with her first. So
right, and once she's a mother, she might not be keen. Is the next adventure?
So what I've done these two already. I've done what I call the long way home from my childhood home down to Dorset. And then I've done what I call hiding in plain sight all around Dorset, sort of looking at things that are there in the landscape that we just walk past. And then my third one, hopefully next year, I'm taking Scarlet back to the Dales, and it's going to be Scarlet Goes Home. So back to her birthplace, all the way up the Pennines. I thought that was...
And having learned your first lesson with her not to travel in the late autumn, you'll presumably do that in the summer, will you?
I'm a fair weather traveller as much as possible. So if someone offers me a bed for the night or some help, I will take it. I don't have to endure more than I need to. So there's a lot to think about for next year. But this last one, that kindness of where people help me, was so appreciated, and it made the journey, the connection with the people, as well as the places I visited.
Roger Sewell, standing with his Dales pony, Scarlet, as swallows dived in and out their nests in the stables. How lovely to have swallows there. And that recording was made for the Dorset Life podcast, and many thanks to the editor, Laura Hitchcock, for letting me use it. You're listening to Countryside Matters with me, Jenny Devitt. And finally, in today's programme, we return to the World Heritage Day and Jurassic Coast at 25 event held in April in Dorchester, and hear more from some of the people Andy Worth of Keep 106 met there.
So my name is Scott Welland. I'm the Operations and Experience Manager for the National Trust in West Dorset. So we're here today to tell the public how the National Trust looks after the Jurassic Coast. So we have some key sites that we're responsible for managing: High Beach at Burton Bradstock, Ringstead Bay, some of the coastline around Golden Cap Estate and Stonebarrow. So we're here to talk about how we look after those pieces of land, how we care for them, and what people can do when they come and visit us at those sites.
So where do they visit and what can they visit?
So they can come and visit us at High Beach, which in West Dorset is our busiest site, which is a fantastic stretch of coastline, absolutely stunning piece of land. We have activities going down there. Our most popular activities at High Beach and across all these sites is our walks. So we have lots of walks available online, walks of maps on site. People can come and do a self-led walk, but we also have a walking program where people can book on, and one of our walk volunteers will lead them around these sites, tell them a little bit about the history, the archaeology, the Jurassic Coast itself, and just get outside and enjoy the scenery.
Well, I can see the connection with heritage, but how do you view heritage?
Well, it's incredibly important, isn't it? We are responsible for the land in our care, and it's a privilege for us to be able to look after it and to make it accessible to other people. So I think that's a big part of what our role is how we can make these sites accessible to people so that they can enjoy that heritage and be part of it.
So how do they find out about all these wonders?
The easiest way in this day and age is to go online. It's where a lot of the effort is being put into is the digital platform. So go to our websites. You can go to the National Trust main website and then you can find us through there. But all the sites that we look after, so High Beach, Ringstead, Golden Cap, they all do have their own websites where you can find out information about those sites.
Well, that's worth knowing. Thank you.
What we have here are some virtual reality headsets. So last year we were very lucky to get some special grant money to do some virtual reality filming around Blossom. The aim of the project was to send a drone over Ringstead Bay and capture some of the Blossom, which wasn't very accessible or isn't accessible at all to most people. By having it on a drone and in virtual reality, we can take that Blossom images to anyone. So it could be to people in care homes, could be to children at schools, or it could be events like this so people can just experience in that. And while we were there with our video photographer capturing the drone stuff at Ringstead Bay, we also got them to fly over High Beach and also around the Golden Cap Estate. So we've got those three films. We have five virtual reality headsets, and people today can pop on a headset and spend 5 minutes flying over the Jurassic Coast.
I'm Peter Brackey, chairman of SPAB in Dorset. SPAB is the Society for the Protection of Ancient Buildings. SPAB will be 150 years old next year. It's one of the earliest conservation societies. Obviously, ancient buildings and the Jurassic Coast don't have that much in common, but we've concentrated today on producing a display of historic buildings which are close to or intimately connected with the Jurassic Coast. And we've got a list, and we're inviting people to add to the list if they know of buildings that we should be showing. Talking points more than anything else, one or two quite obscure buildings that people may not know about, and others that are, like, there's some Weymouth seafront pictures here. I mean, that is as intimate as you can get with the sea and the coast.
So are these dwellings, or can it be any type of building?
I would say the majority of them are, the really old ones are not dwellings. We've got churches and chapels, Henry VIII forts, things like that illustrated here. I can see Rufus Castle down there in one picture. Interesting historic buildings that are one way or another closely associated with the coast.
So how do you fund any renovations if you're involved in that?
The Society does provide limited support for renovation projects. More than anything else, it has a fairly, I would say, well-defined policy on conservation, which is repair, not restore, so to speak. And we do have a massive resource of technical information available through our headquarters in London, you can ring up and ask technical advice on conserving a historic building and get the best advice that way. We publish quarterly magazines to our members. There are technical leaflets on repair of historic buildings, which we have a few of here today. And we're here to drum up members and to raise the profile of the society.
So, if someone wanted to be a member, what do they have to do?
You can do it through the society's website, and if you are going to go for the whole hog, it's £65 a year for a membership.
But sounds reasonable.
You can get a monthly newsletter free. For the newsletter, you only have to use the QR code on this. It keeps you up to date with what's happening. As a regional group here, with the Dorset group, we organise visits to interesting projects and interesting historic buildings that you can't normally get into. For a fee, of course. You can join these visits and learn about buildings and conservation techniques and things like that. That's our main function, really, is to supply local members with interesting information, places to visit.
My name is Steve Oliver. I work for the Dorset Wildlife Trust, and we have a potential project that we're proposing with regards to releasing beavers into the wild on the River Frome catchment. So today we're at the Town Hall in Dorchester here to talk to members of the public about what it means to have beavers back in a local landscape. So this is all part of a public consultation where we want to hear the views and thoughts of landowners and all the general public, basically, and hopefully get them to feed into a project for the future and be part of something really special.
And what's the purpose of that?
Beavers used to be widespread over our freshwater systems across the county and across the UK. Sadly, around 400 years ago, they disappeared completely, but they're being brought back. So as of October 2022, they're recognised as a resident native species again in England. There are already some wild beavers living in Dorset, but what we want to see in the future is beavers return into many of our freshwater habitats and being part of a genetically diverse population, which is able to cope with climate change, disease, and really thrive in the future. And beavers are such an important species. I mean, there's nothing that can replicate what a beaver can do in the landscape. They're such an important animal with regards to other wildlife and other biodiversity. So it's such a positive story that beavers are returning. But we're here in Dorchester to talk to the community so that beavers return in the right way and everyone understands what it is like to have beavers in a local landscape again.
They help with wetlands.
Absolutely. So they're a keystone species. They're quite often termed as an ecosystem engineer. So they have the ability to maybe coppice a tree, build a dam. That slows water down. And as you say, they can create a wetland. And water's the source of all life. I mean, without water, we would not be here. We need it for our cups of tea, and we need it for our beer and our wine. We need it for life. And an animal that can help to keep water on land for longer is going to generate life in the landscape. Having such an influential animal out there is a no-brainer with regards to wildlife. I mean, they're going to just generate that life in the landscape. There's so many animals that thrive around beaver wetlands. Amphibians, if you take amphibians as an example, frogs, toads, newts, I mean, they are going to be thriving in the wetlands that beavers are going to be creating. So there's lots of animals that will benefit from having these animals back in the landscape. It comes as a challenge for us as humans. Living alongside such an influential animal, again, is a challenge, but the benefits massively outweigh any negatives, and it's all about learning to coexist with a species again. That's the key thing, learning to live alongside beavers, maximising benefits, reducing any potential conflict.
What are the controversial points?
Having such an influential animal in the landscape, which we're not used to living alongside, an example of where there could be conflict, a beaver dam can create great wetland habitat, but a beaver dam in the wrong place might cause a potential trouble. So as a really simple example, imagine a road culvert where water flows under a road. You wouldn't want a beaver building a dam across that road culvert. So it's a case of managing certain situations, looking out for situations which might potentially cause trouble and being aware of it and then stepping in if necessary, basically. Also, maybe a beaver dam flooding an area of land which was maybe being used for agriculture. That could also potentially be a problem, but that is where we want to work alongside landowners and farm managers and try to create space around water. So providing buffer zones so that beavers can return, our water can be improved on our rivers and the diversity and everything with it, and hopefully in the future, along with that making space, hopefully rewarding landowners for doing it. So hopefully getting funding so that buffer strips and that sort of thing along our watercourses can be rewarding, so land managers can get funding for doing that, and that's what we want to see in the future, because no one should lose out from beavers coming back. We want to see space being made around our water, protect the most vital resource we have, and hopefully everyone should be a winner from that in the future.
Well, I know there are sites where beavers are already present. How is that going?
Yeah, so across Dorset and the surrounding counties, there's already small populations of wild beavers living. We have also had our Dorset Wildlife Trust enclosed project site up and running for 5 years now. So we've got a local site in the headwaters of the River Froome catchment, and it's a fine example of what beavers can do in the landscape. So they've really added to the complexity of the wetland habitat there over the last 5 years, with the dam building that they've done, and knock-on benefits of for all the different wildlife that's living there. And what we want to do in the future with this wild release proposal, and why we're having this consultation and inviting views of the public, etc., we want to take the successes of the enclosed project out into the wider landscape. That is what we want to see in the future. We want to see more beavers living wild. We want to see people benefiting from it, all the wildlife benefiting from it. We want to see a successful coexistence once again.
And that's it for today's Countryside Matters. It just remains for me to thank you for listening and to thank the Gardens Group for its support of this programme. Until next time, this is Jenny Devitt saying goodbye to you. Bye-bye.